next speaker is Dr. Kevin Murphy. Dr. Murphy studied as an undergraduate at the University of East Anglia in Norwich with a year of studying at the University of California, Berkeley. He completed his PhD at Imperial College London looking at mechanisms in brain regulation appetite. He is now a senior lecturer in Imperial College, and his current research focuses on how the gut senses nutrients in order to regulate hunger and satiety, and how central nervous system controls this. And today, Dr. Murphy will speak on the role of gut-brain signaling in regulation of food intake. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks very much to the organizers for inviting me to speak, and thanks very much for Bill for giving a good introduction to the hypothalamic circuits regulating appetite. I'm actually going to go a bit upstream of that. I'm going to be talking a bit about the gut hormones that actually feed into particularly those arcuate nucleus circuits to regulate food intake. So I probably don't need to introduce the subject of obesity. This is obviously the average North American child these days. And while there are very minor advantages to being larger, I think that the general consensus is, for the most part, that being fat is not terribly good for you outside of a kidnap scenario. So with that in mind, of course, what we're really focused on in the lab I work in Imperial College is how can we stop it? And I think most people would agree that while there is pharmacotherapy out there, it's at the best only modestly effective, and that we actually do have a very good cure for obesity and the associated diabetes in bariatric surgery. The trouble is it's a very difficult one to roll out for the increasing number or the increasing levels of obesity that we see across the developed and increasingly in the developing world. So as I say, the signals I'm talking about feed into the hypothalamus, but I'm more interested in things that we can use to manipulate the hypothalamus more easily than current pharmacotherapy does. I think one of the difficulties with a lot of the drugs that are seeking to influence these central circuits directly, of course, is that within the central nervous system, your specificity is conferred by point-to-point wiring, but as soon as you're creating a drug to try and affect those circuits, then you just wash over all of them, and because of that, a lot of the drugs that we use tend to be dogged by side effects. So I guess the research in the laboratory I work on gut hormones started with the question, well, what is it that makes you feel full following a meal? So what is it when you've eaten a large calorie intake that makes you both want to stop eating that meal, if it's a large one, and also probably puts off how long until you eat your next meal afterwards? And so there's been various hypotheses about these, whether it's a full stomach. Well, certainly if you've got a distended stomach, you have mechanoreceptors that come in, and you obviously get some kind of signal. But then if you do experiments where you fill balloons with water in the stomach, or even on a more lo-fi level, things like the cabbage diets that are so popular, where you're trying to, well, I say so popular, that's the wrong word, but people have tried before, the idea that you're distending the stomach with very low-calorie food, and what you find is that people actually still feel pretty hungry on those diets. And similarly, it doesn't necessarily seem to be the nutrients absorbed. So full parental nutrition, infusing people with the nutrients they need, still you tend to end up feeling pretty hungry. And so we work on the basis that maybe an awful lot of the signal about making you terminate a meal and putting off your next meal is due to hormones that signal from the gastrointestinal tract. So this is a fairly simplistic schematic diagram, just showing some of the hormones that are released from the gastrointestinal tract. Those ones in bold are ones which have pretty well characterized effects on the regulation of food intake. The ones I particularly want to talk about today are glucagon-like peptide 1 and oxyntomodulin, and also peptide YY, which are released from an endocrine cell called the L cell. There's some debate as to whether the L cell is actually just one entity, but for simplicity's sake, I'll behave it as if it is today. And so, again, in the kind of gut hormones 101 study, the idea being that you eat your food intake, it hopefully goes into the gastrointestinal tract, all being well, and the macronutrients in that food come into contact with the L cell, where they're sensed by a variety of mechanisms and stimulate the release of these gut hormones, which then signal to the appetite centers in the brain. And again, there's debate at what level this happens at. Certainly the arcuate nucleus seems to be important, probably also the brain stem, which then signals to the hypothalamus as well. And then hopefully this is what gives you your feeling of fullness. and results in you terminating that meal and also inhibiting the or increasing the time until your next meal. And one of the reasons we're particularly interested in this in a minute is because, as I say, bariatric surgery is pretty difficult to roll out for the general population, but what if you can come up with a more medicinal form of bariatric surgery? So essentially, what we know is that if you look at bariatric surgery, that it's not a problem with malabsorption that causes you to lose weight. Essentially, the gut responds and your absorption is pretty normal, but your appetite does appear to decrease pretty dramatically. And one of the mechanisms that this might be happening is because if you look at people who've had bariatric surgery, they have grossly altered levels of gut hormones, both baseline and in response to a meal. So, and in particular, those ones I'm talking about seem to be elevated with bariatric surgery, so PYY and GLP-1, etc. So the idea is that, can we actually get the effects of bariatric surgery without having to do the surgery? Can we just hijack this gut hormone system and use that to input into the brain instead? So the first very simple question based on that is, well, can you reduce food intake with these in humans with these hormones? And the answer is yes. So intravenous administration of peptide YY or GLP-1 or oxyntomodulin, all of these things reduces food intake in humans. And this is a paper quite a while ago by Rachel Bantram in the New England Journal, just showing as well that essentially an infusion of PYY, you can reduce food intake at buffet meal by about a third, and this happens in both obese and in lean volunteers. And GLP-1, oxyntomodulin, can also have similar effects on appetite in humans. So based on that, well, that's all very well being able to reduce a single meal, but of course you're going to need to be able to do this chronically in order to reduce body weight. So can we use these hormones to reduce body weight? So a few years ago we ran a study using oxyntomodulin. So volunteers were given vials like this with oxyntomodulin or saline with it. It was a double-blinded study, they didn't know what they were getting, and they were asked to inject themselves three times a day before their meals with the contents of that vial. This is actually poor Dr. Adrian Park, who is forever immortalized for his love handles, because we use this slide to illustrate how people were asked to inject themselves. So here he is injecting himself with oxyntomodulin before a meal. And what we found is that, yes, with this kind of chronic administration protocol, you can get a reduction in acute reductions in food intake, and chronically you get weight loss as well. So essentially, compared to the group injecting themselves with saline, you get probably about 2.5 kilograms weight loss over a month. Now, we're actually limited by the ethics that we were running under, how long we could run this study for, but at least promisingly, the weight loss seemed to still be continuing at the 4-week point. So that's all well and good. Obviously, I've proven that you can cure obesity with gut hormones. Obviously, I'd be very, very foolish to cure obesity before I retire. And given the current economic situation, that's probably looking at about age 85 or something. So luckily, there are some problems that give me something to work on for 50 years or so. So I guess one of the big problems with gut hormones, the reason that we ask these people to inject themselves three times a day is that they don't last very long. So basically, the way that you control this, the way you can cycle your hunger up and down, relies on the fact that they have quite short half-lives. The other problem seems to be that the anorectic effects can wear off. And that depends very much on the administration protocol, but certainly continuous administration, so giving a pump that infuses you with these gut hormones so you have a permanently high level, you seem to get tachyphylaxis. So essentially, people become resistant to their anorectic effects. And perhaps the main difficulty as well is that essentially there's a relatively narrow therapeutic window. So at a certain level, these hormones reduce your appetite without causing nausea, and you push above that barrier, and essentially you make people feel sick. It's very easy to get people to lose weight if they're feeling sick, but it's not necessarily that great in an anti-obesity drug. And perhaps this is maybe because when we're talking about hormones, and I've given a rather simplistic idea of their action, they probably code for some more sophisticated information than we've given them credit for in the past. So perhaps in the short term, after a meal, you get this brief elevation that causes a termination of a meal. What we also find, if you look at a lot of gut diseases, especially those associated with malabsorption, you get a kind of chronic elevation of gut hormones. So the baseline tends to be high, and their release after a meal tends to be high as well. And perhaps that's to reduce the stress on the gut, for example, if you've got a disease that means you shouldn't eat for a while or you need to clear out the gastrointestinal tract. And then the other effect seems to be acute nausea. So perhaps toxin ingestion seems to stimulate very high levels of these hormones to be released acutely, and that causes nausea. So basically, you're trying to hijack this mechanism without kick-starting this mechanism in order to treat obesity. So we can make longer-lasting versions. Obviously, I'm sure you recognize the Gila monster there. Reassuringly, the actual lizard is slightly smaller in real life, I'm told. So the reason that's up there is because of exenatide. So exenatide is a GLP-1-like drug, which is essentially acts like GLP-1 with much a better half-life. And while it's licensed to treat diabetes at the minute because of its incretin effect, it also causes weight loss as well. So essentially a long-acting form of GLP-1 that can cause weight loss without you having to inject yourself three times a day. We're following along this process by trying to design analogs based on the oxyntomodulin molecule, so analyzing how it's broken down within the body, then trying to target particular amino acid substitutions or extensions to the peptide chain which stop it being removed from the body quite so quickly. And the idea is that hopefully we can increase the potency of the receptor, but also increase its duration of effect. And one of these oxyntomodulin analogs we've been working on. So this is just, don't worry too much about the details. This is just a single subcutaneous injection, and this is rats. This is their cumulative food intake over 3 days, and this is the saline in black. And this is just showing at the highest dose of this oxyntomodulin analog, you're actually reducing their food intake from that single injection for a 72-hour. Period. And this oxyntomodulin analog is actually in phase 3 trials now. It was bought by Wyeth. And can we avoid tachyphylaxis? Can we avoid those effects wearing off? Well, as I say, you get chronic elevation in gut bypass, and maybe the trick is that although it's chronically elevated in fasting, you actually still get these periodic bursts after eating where it's increased acutely. Perhaps, though, we need to bear in mind that the versions that we can make that are the longest lasting aren't necessarily going to be the best. We need to look at the way that we're administering this. Maybe we need some kind of pulsatile release. Way of getting around the nausea might be to give low doses of different hormones together. So this is a paper by Ben Field published last year from our department, basically just showing the reduction in energy intake giving low doses of PYY and oxyntomodulin. But if you give both of them together within their therapeutic windows where they're not causing nausea or not causing so much nausea, you can get a fairly decent reduction in energy intake at a buffet meal without the same side effects that you would get with a high dose of either peptide. And I guess just to finish with, maybe the point we're at when we're looking at drugs to combat obesity. So we used to have some very, very effective drugs to combat obesity. They were called amphetamines. Apparently, they had some side effects. The next generation of drugs have some side effects as well, and then their efficacy essentially isn't as good as the old-style ones. So where the legislational climate is more interested in side effects than essentially is efficacy these days. And I guess maybe the hope is that the next generation of drugs will be effective and well-tolerated, and perhaps in combination. Perhaps a useful analogy is something like the control of blood pressure, where virtually everybody who's on some kind of blood pressure control, you're targeting the system at multiple points to get an effect. So maybe the future of obesity treatment is in multiple injections of these hormones to try and get an effect. Oh, that would be my second electric shock. So maybe we can make small molecule agonists, but the nature of these receptors seems to make that very difficult. And then the final thing that I wanted to mention today is that maybe actually what we want to do is, rather than manipulating the gut hormones themselves, maybe we can even go further upstream. Maybe we can manipulate our diets in such a way that they stimulate the release of gut hormones. Now, the thing is to bear in mind about dietary manipulation is that if you could manipulate everybody's diets anyway, you wouldn't really need a cure for obesity. So the thing to bear in mind is that what you need to do is do this surreptitiously, perhaps the wrong word, but in a way that doesn't put consumers off. So functional foods are becoming more popular in the marketplace. We know that the L cell, which releases these hormones, responds to things, macronutrients, glucose, fatty acids, and amino acids. So maybe we can manufacture agonists which stimulate these receptors more effectively. Maybe we can encapsulate macronutrients to target specific parts of the gut more effectively. But as I say, most importantly, we need to bear in mind is that consumers need to want to eat them. So in order for these things to be effective, you have to create a food product that people want to eat. That's the trouble with obesity these days. But if we can smuggle in something that's good for them at the same time, then perhaps we can reduce the rates of obesity. And obviously, I did all of this work myself, and these people just watched me. Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for entertaining talk. there are a couple of questions here, please. Yep. Yes.
I guess I will be able to ask the tricky question and everybody might hear that. Well, just in the interest of full disclosure, I work, my main job is with a pharmaceutical company, Pfizer. And my career actually started with Pfizer, working on drugs for obesity. I will not reveal anything that would cause a breach of intellectual property. But, of course, we have been interested in several of those molecules, and we are still interested, actually, in one of those. You know. The problem, of course, there are many problems, but in the end, the main problem is the benefit-to-risk ratio, and also the practicality of the administration of these drugs. Maybe we can get into this later on, maybe the two of us, but what I would like to stimulate you, just in line with your stimulating presentation, is... Since it's definitely a dynamic system, our energy balance regulation, do you think that would be helpful to have a kind of a sequential administration of different modulators of gut-to-brain axis communication? And second question, are two different questions, although interrelated. Do you think that more work around phenotyping obesity, continuing and enhancing the work that, for example, John Bladel is doing, would help understand the responsiveness of specific individuals to specific modulators? Because there is, of course, inter-individual variability in responses, and everybody knows that we are going toward a world where precision medicine, personalized medicine, will be the way to do things, because we'll enhance, of course, the benefit-to-risk ratio for that specific individual, the specific condition, and so also the FDA, maybe, or EMEA, regulatory agencies, will look at these things with more favorable eyes. Just offer your thoughts on this. Thanks.
Yes. I think, essentially, people's response to these hormones, it can be, there's quite a wide continuum, and as I say, when we're talking about the narrow therapeutic window, what you're actually looking at is, in general, it's a narrow therapeutic window because a certain percentage of these people respond with nausea. However, even at some levels where you're getting real nausea in some people, you're not getting it in all of the subjects. So I think certainly probably the eventual idea would be that you could perhaps tailor a combination of these hormones towards the specific person, or hopefully a specific type, because obviously it's going to be fairly expensive and time-consuming to come up with a profile for anyone. At the minute, I'd have to say in humans that's pretty difficult. When we did the oxyntomodulin chronic study, we actually found one of the persons who dropped out of it dropped out because they reported severe nausea, and we actually measured their oxyntomodulin levels after administration. We found out that while they were getting the same injection as everybody else, their post-injection profile of oxyntomodulin immune activity was completely different, and what we presume is that their ability to deal with oxyntomodulin at some kind of enzymatic level was compromised. They actually got levels that were about, I think, sort of 3 or 4 times higher than everybody else in the study. And so that's probably a more specific case, but it gives you an idea of the difficulties that you have with administering these drugs. So yes, certainly I think being able to tailor it would be quite helpful. During my waffling there, I've managed to forget what the first question was.
Asking about the convenience or opportunity, let's say, to do a sequential treatment. So start, for example, with one molecule, and then when the system adapts, of course, there are many issues here, so it's a very simplistic idea that I'm offering, therefore, for your thoughts, because, of course, many of these molecules work on the same systems, so the adaptation to one, of course, will work also for others. But there are some molecules, drugs that have completely different
PYY through the Y2 versus GLP-1 through the GLP-1 receptor and so on, rather than GLP-1 and oxyntomodulin, it probably wouldn't work. I think the difficulty in switching between them is that actually with your continuous administration, the tachyphylaxis seems to appear relatively quickly, probably. So I wonder if maybe you're better off changing your administration protocol rather than changing your drug. And so when I say in combination, I'm actually probably imagining we're going to be administering these things at the same time. I think the difficulty with kind of drug licensing at the minute is that it's not a system that's really set up for testing multiple drugs at the same time. It costs you an awful lot of money, an awful lot of effort to prove that they're going to be effective. So I think that's a major difficulty.
Angelo asked a question on pharma. I need to ask a question on food. That line of work, I will already come back with the same question. What insights could it give in terms of a more effective management of one's diet, or in terms of policy or business strategy, if we are to tackle obesity better than we do now?
I guess because we're at it from a more pharmacological point of view than a business strategy. I've been looking a little bit at the things like the market share of functional foods and so on in terms of manipulating these systems, which certainly seem to be growing. But as I say, the bottom line seems to be that people will eat stuff that they think is good for them, but actually they'll eat stuff that they think is good for them that tastes nice, basically. So in terms of policy for a food manufacturer, I think the bottom line is that the market is saturated, and what people eat is what they want to eat. That is what essentially drives obesity. So if you're going to be able to try and tackle obesity in that way, you have to play it on the terms of the market, basically. So you have to give people what they want and make it good for them, which is the difficulty, basically. So can you fool the brain into thinking that it's getting these nice high-calorie things? Can you hit these reward systems without actually bringing the calories with it? And I think that's a real challenge.
Thanks. Just a comment on that. I mean, I think we need to look at this, that the sort of the processes that the brain do that are unconscious, right, are driving all of the behavior. So once you understand that that's the kernel of the behavior, all the rest sort of makes sense.
Thanks for the terrific talk. I have a question about timing. So in the course of a normal meal trigger events, how long does it take the chime to actually get into the large intestine? And what are the time profiles of these different gut hormones? Are they actually meal termination signals or much longer term consequences?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And I think perhaps we've worked on a more simplistic model before where people have tried to avoid thinking about that a bit. In terms of the profiles, it depends very much on the type of food you're eating and how solid it is and so on. But you can get rises in a lot of the anorectic hormones that we think have probably been released from lower down the gut within 20 or 30 minutes. And so presumably there's some kind of neural signal. So it's not simply the enteroendocrine cells sensing directly the gut contents. It's always difficult to show exactly where those hormones are coming from, and they are distributed throughout the small and the large intestine, but there seems to be a reason maybe the majority of it's in the colon. In terms of timing, what's kind of interesting, I think, is that maybe when we're looking at these things as purely satiety signal, actually there seems to be some time effects encoded in them as well. So, for example, peptide YY. If you inject an animal with peptide YY, you reduce food intake within an hour or two, for the next hour or two, and then you get what we often refer to as something called an overswing effect. So then for 3 to 4 or 5 to 6 hours afterwards, you'll see them increase food intake. So basically their 24-hour intake, well, from that single injection, ends up being the same because they eat more to compensate. But what happens, weirdly, with PYY is that if you actually give them the injection of PYY and take away their food so they can't eat for that bit where they would usually reduce their food intake, what you find is that they still get an overswing effect. They still eat more about 5 to 6 hours later. And so maybe there's a more sophisticated kind of data encoded within the gut hormone profile. Maybe a lot of it is about spacing your meals throughout the day or timing when your next meal is. And I think probably that they have a greater role in something like that, putting off one meal for a certain time, but then also making sure that somehow those signals get switched on so that they're not activated permanently and you do have another meal at some point. But I think that the study of that is very much in its infancy.
So we have time for one more question.
Just going back to your oxyntomodulin study, presumably the weight loss seen with oxyntomodulin was related with a decrease in the appetite. Did you measure energy expenditure? Were there any changes in the energy expenditure? Was it decreased, the same, or increased?
In that study, we didn't measure energy expenditure. We did measure food intake at the beginning and the end, and it was reducing food intake at a buffet meal. However, in a separate study, when we look at extentomodulin and energy expenditure, we find that it does seem to have an effect on energy expenditure. It seems to be in rodents and in humans as well. And the way that we're measuring it probably isn't terribly sophisticated, but it seemed to be in non-voluntary behaviours, if you will. So essentially, people didn't realise they were expending more energy, but it wasn't changing their basal metabolic rate or anything like that. But they did seem to be expending more energy. Essentially, I often describe this to students as jiggling about a bit. You often see it on kind of those documentaries where they talk about people who have phenotypes that are resistant to weight or whatever, and they're slightly nervy-looking people. And so I guess if I had to explain it, I think maybe that's what extentomodulin is affecting. Maybe it's making you tap your fingers a bit more, or basically people you wouldn't want to be trapped in a lift with for very long. So how that impacts on its use as a therapy, I think we need to see. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you.